Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast.
Welcome back to Right on Four Corners. I'm Delcherie Gladden. I'm a journalist, editor, and author of over 30 published novels. And on this week's episode, I have Deborah and Ralph Blumenthal, and they're going to be talking about their newest children's book. Deborah, let's start with you. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
I am a children's book author, the author of 27 books for children and adults. And this is my first venture of writing with my husband, so this is rather exciting. We usually work independently. And I'm also a former contributor to the New York Times, where I covered health, fitness, and beauty. And I also have a background in nutrition.
I was with the New York Times for 45 years as a staff reporter. I still contribute to the Times. I was on the group of reporters who broke the story in 2017 of the secret Pentagon office investigating UFOs. And I've been writing about UFOs in the New York Times. So this was a great collaboration. My wife is an expert in children's book writing, and I have the background in UFOs, so we got together.
That's interesting. I was wondering how this idea came together.
It's a good question, actually, how it originated. You know, for the past several years, I've been listening to Ralph do various interviews on UFOs, and it struck me that, gee, there's no children's book on this topic. There have been numerous books on UFOs, many of them fictitious, but nothing really in the picture book area that was simple, factual, and informative for kids. So I said, wow, we should work together and do a book. So that was really how it all started.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point that there are a lot of books, fanciful books on aliens and, speculative books. We wanted to really build out from the New York Times reporting, which is strictly factual, on these objects that have been seen and verified in the skies and sometimes underwater, but no one knows what they are, where they come from, who or what is driving them. So we wanted to provide a basic introduction to young people who are seeing these stories on TV and hearing their parents talk about them, and we wanted to give them a factual, basic understanding that this is a genuine mystery that may or may not be solved in their lifetimes, but it's out there, literally, and it's fascinating. And we wanted to just eliminate a lot of the speculation.
Well, and that was something that I found really interesting, because when I first got it through UNM Press, they sent me the advanced copy of it to read the book, and I wasn't totally sure what I was going to get. Because most of the books related to UFOs that I've seen and when my kids were little reading those are fun, they're fictitious, they're cute stories, things like that. And this one did focus a lot more on, let's give some information on what has been seen, what's being talked about in a more scientific sense. And how did you guys blend that need for fact and rising above, I guess, some of the more, I like that term you used, fanciful stories surrounding UFOs when talking to children? Because that is such a challenging aspect of writing children's books. It's a very different way of approaching a reader. Children are just such a different group than if you were writing this for adults.
Right. Our main interest was keeping it simple and basic and thought-provoking. A book that would draw parents and children to sit down and examine what we don't know, what we hope to find out. And so we actually didn't pay a lot of attention to the goofy stuff that's out there. That's not of interest to me. We wanted to keep it very basic, and we wanted it to fall in the nonfiction category and hope. Hopefully it will be a resource book for libraries and schools and bring this discussion to light.
And what struck us, too, is that even young children understand and think about things way beyond what adults often think they're capable of.
Right.
And there's a lot of news coverage floating around. They see it on TV. They hear their parents talking about it. They see headlines in the newspaper. And even though they don't understand all that stuff, they certainly have a feeling that there's a mysterious subject out there that is often stigmatized. And people are afraid to talk about it, ashamed to talk about it if they've had sightings of their own. So kids are often more sophisticated than we think. And we think that they're ready to be informed about this subject in a non-sensational, factual way. And that was really our driving motive.
So coming back to that readiness, what age group would you say that this book is most appropriate for to get started with?
It's certainly the older picture book reader. I think on Amazon, you know, it's a 6 to 9. I really think it goes beyond age 9. It really is a book for anyone who wants the basics of what we know about UFOs. Yes, it's full of pictures, so it's a picture book.
And we think it's also a book for parents to read and talk about with their children, and they can use this as a jumping off point. So it's not limited to children of those years. Sophisticated children, young readers, younger than 6, might find it interesting, should find it interesting, and certainly older kids who like to go back and look at the pictures. By the way, the illustrations are by an artist friend of ours who illustrated another of Debbie's books, Adam Gustafson, who's a wonderful artist and who really captured the feel of this mystery.
Exactly.
So it's a lot of fun to look at the pictures because he renders the mysterious aspects and the factual aspects. He blends them in a way that makes for very compelling art. We're particularly proud of the picture book aspect.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. I really enjoyed the illustrations as well. I thought it set a very nice tone for the book. Mm-hmm. It wasn't too, I guess, cutesy.
Right.
It had a serious feel to it, but it still had that element of being very appealing to young children. I have a friend who's an illustrator, and so I've learned a little bit about that process from her working with authors and agencies. So that's interesting that this was someone that you knew and that you have worked with before. Were you able then to request that Gustafson be your illustrator for this one?
Yes, in this case, the University of New Mexico Press does not publish too many children's picture books. They've done picture books in the past, so they were open to our suggestions, and I knew Adam was interested in the topic, and I just had a feeling he'd be fabulous doing the art, and he, in fact, was, so I knew he was a great candidate, and they were very taken with his work.
It's a great catch for us because he's very accomplished, as you can see from the illustrations. He does marvelous oil paintings and illustrations on his own. And we were actually a little embarrassed to be asking him to join us on this because we didn't know how he, you know, what would he think about it. It turned out, as Debbie said, he's a great fan of the subject and he plunged into it. He turned these illustrations out in record time and very cleverly captured both the mystery and the reality of this phenomenon because it's a complicated thing to render. These things in the sky are very mysterious. There are pictures of them, but not very good pictures. The Navy has caught them on radar, but there's an element of mystery, and he has captured that, and also the human reaction to these objects. The old lady who sees one of these things and calls the police, and the police in her house talking to her about it. Adam really captured that, and he's an artist in his own right. I mean, a very accomplished artist, and we were so glad to get him.
Well, I'm glad that that was able to work out. It seems like it can be a really complicated process to work between publishers and authors and illustrators and get it just right. So that's really neat that UNM Press was willing to be open to those suggestions and rely on, especially yours, Deborah, your expertise in that, having worked with many illustrators over your career writing children's books.
And you know when it's right, and he didn't disappoint.
While we're talking about illustrations, the book starts off with the story of two little boys on a tennis court at night playing tennis and looking up and seeing this object, this UFO, hovering above the tennis court. And the adults who were playing nearby saw it too. So it's multiple sightings. And this story is actually a true story that I dealt with in a book I wrote 2 years ago about a Harvard psychiatrist who was very interested in UFOs and really did some groundbreaking research. And I tell the story in that book of two little boys who saw a UFO on the tennis court. And I transferred that story to our children's book because it's a very immediate way of
It grounds the story, absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. It grounds the story in real characters. And we say at the end of the book, Wes and Ken are real people who had this sighting. There's a documentary element.
Right. There's nothing fictitious in the book at all. Referred to a sighting in Zimbabwe, and that absolutely took place.
Like you mentioned earlier, this can be a topic that can be difficult for people to take seriously. So tell me about your approach to pitching this and just kind of what that process was.
Well, you know, it's an interesting topic because some people are fascinated with it and others wave it away. So, yes, we did experience that, you know, going out into the world with the book. But the University of New Mexico Press is obviously close to the subject. And Ralph had a very good experience working with them on his book, The Believer. So we felt this is the right home for this book. And that's why we ended up working with them.
Yeah, we got a very good reception from them. And as Debbie said, they don't usually publish children's books. So
Right. This
was kind of a new area for them. And they were excited to be branching out into the field. And I don't have to tell you the connection that New Mexico has
Right. With
this phenomenon. It's a great place to center the book or have it published because of the close association with Roswell and other sightings. It seems that that part of the country is particularly prone to strange paranormal events for reasons we do not understand, but that are well documented, that this is a center of this kind of activity. So growing out of my happy experience with UNM Press, we thought it would be a perfect home, and the editors really encouraged us right away, Stephen Hull and others. So we found a very receptive audience there.
That's really neat, because I was wondering, as I was looking through the UNM Press spring catalog, definitely not a lot of children's picture books there.
Right.
It was a unique one that stood out. And I did wonder if, because it was the topic of UFOs, that New Mexico does have that history there, not only with Roswell, throughout the state. I'm here in Farmington, and one of our neighboring cities, Aztec, for years had UFO festival based on sightings and stories that have been told through Aztec. And we have a group here that I was just able to work with, one of our freelancers, who have started a local group that are researching and attempting contact. And it was really neat that all of that kind of came up more recently, and then I saw your book on the press list. This is an interesting topic for our local listeners, but also for people who are just in general interested in the topic. It's one of the few things that New Mexico is known for. I think New Mexico is kind of a blind spot on a lot of people's radar. Chile and aliens, those are definitely two things that people may think of when they think of New Mexico.
You know, there was a writer in your neck of the woods named Max Evans, a cowboy writer, who set some of his books in Farmington and the surrounding area. And he was the one, when I was a New York Times correspondent in Texas and covered New Mexico, he told me about sightings of UFOs by cowboys, who are very down-to-earth people. They're very busy people working on the land and herding cattle, and they don't have time for nonsense. And they saw UFOs, including a cousin of Max Evans's. People there in New Mexico, as you know, are not given to fanciful meanderings or whatever. They're very down-to-earth, hardworking people, busy. And when they see something like that, they try to understand and grapple with it. And to this day, nobody knows, but at least they're credible in their report. And that's what always impressed me, that the people telling these stories are people who have great credibility by and large.
That's a really interesting point. I think you get a lot of popular media surrounding UFO sightings and related topics, and often the way that that's portrayed doesn't lend itself to believability. And I find it very interesting that you are coming at this, especially you, Ralph, from the work you did with the New York Times, and looking at these instances of which ones you included in the book, because like you said, several of the references that you make were of specific incidences that you had researched and been aware of. What was the process that you went through on what to include, what not to include in this book?
Again, we try to keep it strictly factual, and there are a number of incidents in the history of UFOs that really stand out. Roswell certainly is one. Another one was the sighting Deborah referred to in Harare, Zimbabwe, in Africa, when 60 kids, elementary school kids at recess, all saw a UFO land and interacted with some beings that came out. And the children later drew pictures of the craft landing and told the same stories, not that they had rehearsed it together, but that they all saw the same thing. And it remains one of the landmark cases because, as John Mack, the Harvard psychiatrist I wrote about in my earlier book, pointed out, that these children are not likely to make up complicated stories like this. They have not read books about UFOs. They haven't seen movies about UFOs. They just reported what they saw, and they were very straightforward in their accounts. And the accounts kind of meshed. You know, they were all basically the same.
All looked the same, yeah.
And the pictures looked the same. And they didn't, you know, consult each other, what pictures shall we draw? So that's why we referred to that case, because it jumped out at us. There are a number of cases like that. So it wasn't hard to pick those cases.
Well, and with both of you having background in journalism, and it sounds like long established careers, you're very familiar with researching the validity of topics and stories and understanding that. And I found that fascinating when looking at you guys' bios on, you know, where you were coming from, because I think with a topic like UFOs, that's something that most people are going to be like, okay, why this topic and what gives them credibility to talk about this? And you guys have such an interesting, unique background that I was intrigued that you chose to do a children's book on this topic. And so I was curious about your process with writing. And obviously, Deborah, you've been writing children's book for a while. Ralph, for you especially, was this style and the process of writing for young readers different? Did you find that to be a struggle? What was that like for you moving from adult readers?
Yeah, I really defer to Deborah here because she is an accomplished children's book writer, and she knows the rhythm and the right approach to combine simple prose that children will understand and yet something magical about it, because the best books for children have something magical about them. They're kind of lyrical and poetic. And I left that to her, really. She knows a lot more about that than I do.
Well, I'll also interject that over the years, we read each other's work before it's sent out to anyone. So Ralph has a history of reading my books before they go out, and I have a history of reading, you know, many of his projects, especially his book, before that went out. Not to mention, as parents, over the years, we've read our share of children's books to our two girls. So we both felt comfortable writing a book, although it was an interesting process to do it together, because we would, you know, one would do this paragraph and one would do the other, and then we'd send it back and forth on the computers and argue and change. And so there was a lot of back and forth on it, which is great. You know, we helped each other.
Yeah, I mean, it does help to work with somebody you're very close to in life anyway, because you think the same ways in many ways, yet you bring different perspectives to projects. So it's kind of an ideal thing for a writer to work with a spouse, because you're so close anyway that you can, you know, you really collaborate, and ego doesn't really come into it. You know, if one of us thinks that a word is wrong, the other doesn't take it as a big insult. It was the first time we'd really worked together on a book, and it probably won't be the last.
Well, I have to say, I'm very impressed that you guys were able to work together so well on that. I think you may be more on the unique end of the spectrum when it comes to that. From my own experience and from friends, just in general, working with a partner can be very challenging. And when that is someone you're close to on a personal level, that can add another layer of difficulty. I think that that's pretty amazing that you guys were able to take ego out of it and work together so well to develop this book. That's not an easy feat for a lot of people.
Yeah, I'm sure. It's collaborating with anyone is difficult. It is. You're giving up a lot of creative power by allowing someone into the process. But, you know, in many cases, it's a stronger product when you do work it out.
It helped also that we had really separate areas of expertise. I mean, knew the history and background of UFOs from my previous reporting, and Deborah certainly knew children's book writing, which I didn't know. So when one partner in the writing project contributes a particular skill, that helps. There was no competition involved. If we were maybe both children's book writers, maybe we would have clashed over the vision for the book or the expression or the prose, et cetera. But because we came at it from really different perspectives, we were very fortunate in that respect, that we certainly get along very well in every other respect. And this was an extension of it. So, you know, every writing team has to figure this out for themselves. We were very lucky that we meshed so well on it.
Definitely lucky, and I'm glad that that worked so well. And I hope you do contribute on new projects in the future, because this was a really fun book. I really enjoyed it and learned a lot from it, too. I was wondering, with both of you having backgrounds in journalism and working with various editors over your careers, did that influence your ability to write well with each other? Because different editors have different styles, and that can take some getting used to when you're first working with editors. So, I was wondering if that kind of influenced your ability to work well with each other and, like you said, not let ego come into it too much.
I've found over the years that most of the editors are very, very smart people, and they help you, and they make your work look better. And I can only say good things about the editors I've worked with at the publishing houses. They have a lot of experience. They see things. As a writer, you tend to be married to your project, think everything you put down on paper is the greatest. And that's not the case. You know, writing is a long process, and we all do terrible drafts, and slowly but surely, hopefully, the work becomes better and better the more you chip away at it. And I personally have had very good experiences. And actually, our editor at New Mexico Press was quite helpful also, Stephen Hull, in the editing process. It really was, I think, a win-win for everyone involved.
Yeah, no, I mean, we were very fortunate in working with editors who were very supportive, not only Stephen Hull, the editor-in-chief, but the copy editors who were very meticulous about little things. And, you know, when you write something, doesn't matter what it is, for the New York Times or a freelance or a children's book, you miss things, and you don't have the best overall eye because your book is going to be going out to strangers who don't know what went into the book or your thought processes or whatever. They see it cold. So your book has to be able to hit the reader right off as completely fresh and interesting, and you lose that as the writer. You don't have that independent vision. You don't have the ability to see the book fresh. That's the biggest drawback to a writer, that you're sort of locked into what you said before and what you've been thinking. So you need fresh eyes. And they were very good at the UNM Press.
Yeah.
They were also very supportive, which is so important for a writer. You have to feel that you are getting basic respect from an editor, that the editor thinks basically your book is good, your manuscript is good, it's important, it's worth publishing. And that encouragement goes a long way. So we received really good feedback, little things, changes that needed to be made, which turned out to be good suggestions. And Deborah's right. We really had a wonderful relationship with them.
Mm. The ultimate test, of course, is taking the book into a classroom. And those are the people, the kids, are the ones we're writing for. So, you know, I always think every visit to a school is a little mini focus group. And what children get out of it is what's key. And very often reading to children, you realize strengths and weaknesses of a manuscript. So I do look forward to bringing this book to children and getting feedback from them.
Oh, they are a very tough audience.
I mean,
if you don't get their interest right away, and, you know, often at the readings that Deborah does, there are children, very young children, who are sometimes too young. The parents just bring them to babysit them.
Right.
And you have, you know, 1 and 2 year olds sort of wandering around, not paying attention at all. And then you have other kids who sit there rapt. And some of the questions they come up with are just great, because you wouldn't think of those in advance.
Right.
But that's your target audience. And they're a tough one.
That is definitely true. I've done quite a few school visits over the years, usually with middle school or high school students. But yeah, the younger crowd, they are interesting to work with and just hear their thoughts. They can really take some unusual turns that you're not prepared for. And they're so, so honest most of the time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So what are you guys working on next, either combined or individually?
Well, I have, interestingly enough, a little golden book coming out on Iris Apfel, who will be 102, a fashion icon. So that's coming out early in May. And then I have another picture book coming out in 25 on Barbara Hillary, who is the first Black woman to reach the North Pole and the South Pole. She reached the North Pole at age 75, if you could imagine, and the South Pole at almost 79. That was those were extraordinary accomplishments. And I'm excited about that book. That's really in the early stages of it being illustrated right now. I also have a few other manuscripts circulating, so we'll see what happens with those.
Yeah, Deborah's really forging ahead with her children's books. She always has a few in the hopper and very prolific. My books take longer to do when they're more involved, and I really am not working on anything yet, a new project, because there's still so much to do with UFOs. The paperback of my the book, The Believer, came out last year, so that's still, you know, fairly new, and I'm appearing on podcasts and making, you know, live appearances talking about the book at conferences. So that's taking up a lot of my time. And, you know, it's very hard to pick a subject for a book. I often say when I do these speaking engagements that, you know, the author doesn't pick a book to write. The book picks the author. And every book I've done, and the last one was my seventh, the idea sort of came out of something else I was working on. I didn't have to sit around and scratch my head and search for an idea. It kind of landed in my lap. And I think that's the best way, that the book finds you. And so I'm going to wait and see what, you know, catches my fancy next. It's a difficult process. I mean, the last book took me 17 years from start to finish. That was an extraordinary commitment of time and effort. Not all of them are that difficult, but they're all difficult.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
That's a question I get from classes all the time. They say, where do you get your ideas? So I tell them I go to the idea store, and I give them $5 and they give me some ideas. But no, it's a very, to me, that's the hardest part of writing, finding the right ideas and stories that you want to spend tremendous amount of time with, and characters who interest you enough to, you know, that you're willing to let them take over your lives for the next months or years. So that really is,
you know, and the truth is that nobody really knows what a good idea is until the book actually appears. I mean, if you said to an editor, what should I write about, you know, what's a good hot topic, they won't know, because the public is very fickle. Subjects come and go. When the book is a good book, when it's well written and interesting and provocative, it tends to find an audience. So anything can be good if it's done well, and a subject isn't automatically a good book if it's not written
right.
Well. So a lot goes into these discussions, and mainly, I mean, an author has to be really in love with his or her subject in order to spend the time and effort involved. So the first thing is to work on a book that you're really committed to. It can't be like, I need some money, so I'll write a book. I mean, people do that, but that's not the kind of thing that interests me. I'm looking for subjects that grab me, that presumably will grab my readers, and that will keep me interested through the long process it's going to take to do this book, because research takes years, writing takes years, rewriting and editing takes more years. So there's nothing easy about it, but it's very satisfying.
Absolutely. And I hope for both of you that those ideas keep coming. And I wanted to remind readers, because we are out of time, that the book is called UFOs, Mysteries in the Sky. And that's by Deborah and Ralph Blumenthal. And that can be found on basically all the usual places online and through UNM Press. And I just wanted to say thank you guys for taking the time to chat with me today about your new book.
Thank you, Dilsri. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.